Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Well, authors Chris Entwistle and Mark Havens dive deep into the visual heartbeat of jazz and with their new book, Whale, The Visual Language of Prestige Records. It's a celebration of how Prestige Records transformed not only the sound of jazz, but its look. From the bold boundary-pushing album covers to the creative freedom that defined an era, Chris and Mark explore how art, music, and culture came together in mid-century America to create a lasting visual legacy. The book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Bookshop.org, and RIT Press. And Chris and Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, before we delve into the book, how about a little introduction for the both of you? I don't want to do your own intro, but just talk about yourselves and how you got together to write this book and why you decided to write it together and the importance of Whale.
Wow. Well, Chris and I have been friends for many years, and it was sort of a shared passion between music and art. I have a dual background as a graphic designer and industrial designer. Chris is an illustrator, and when you combine those things with a shared passion for music, it's kind of easy to see how we centered on album covers. It was a portion of the music listening experience that we always enjoyed just as much as the music itself was, just kind of diving deep into those album covers. They added so much to the music. And that's how we really started enjoying this area together.
And Ira, I'll say that your introduction was one of that really articulated what we're doing. How you expressed that, I think, was really the way that we approached it. Was we loved the music, we loved the covers, and we thought, let's look at this from the point of view of let's let the graphic design kind of drive what we're doing and pursue it that way, kind of back, you know, sort of a mirror way that it's usually done.
The issue of covers is in a way problematic in an era of MP3s and WAV files. And even when we had CDs, which we still do, yes, it was artwork, but nothing really made art as an album cover. From my point of view, I don't know if you gentlemen agree or not, but in other words, to really get into the art of something and to represent the music, a vinyl record cover was much more important than a small CD cover.
Absolutely. Especially, you know, back when these albums were initially issued, it was huge. And there was very little else besides that album cover to go by, that was issued in conjunction with a particular album. So it really was visually, sort of the end all be all.
I think of a lot of record companies that were out there promoting jazz over the decades. And Verve was one, for example, and there were others as well. Why did you guys focus initially on Prestige? I know it had that reputation for giving artists and designers a lot of latitude, but what was it that drew you to Prestige Records in particular?
Well, part of it was that it was sort of underappreciated, and it has been underappreciated for a long time. You mentioned Verve, which had a strong identity with David Stone Martin, and I think Norman Grant's probably had a clear idea of how he wanted to present the music. Most jazz from this year, when people look at it, they're thinking of Blue Note, which has just about eclipsed every other label, in terms of the design and the way it's presented and, you know, the way that in a lot of ways, the way that it's been preserved. Prestige, we thought was underappreciated. We thought it's never really been seen as the body of work that it is. And part of it, too, is that it had such a diverse group of people doing the design that any single one of them was going in a different direction or there would really be something that another label might use as their entire identity. And there were about 50 different directions going on there. And to see it as a body of work for us, it took on a life of its own.
How did you know to look at it as a body of work? Because I would imagine, and correct me, gentlemen, if I'm wrong, when the artists and the designers and the engineers and everybody involved with Prestige Records over those years, when they turned out albums and recordings, Did they know that they were looking to create this synthesis of visual artistry as well as audio artistry?
That's I would say only unconsciously.
That's really interesting, because when we talked to the musicians and we talked to the label owner, Bob Weinstock, and other producers, you know, they had said that the musicians were concerned almost solely with the music. But the artists, on the other hand, they loved the music and wanted to be involved with the music. Their art in many ways was inspired by the music. And so the artists, the designers, they cared very much about that sort of fusion of the music and the imagery.
And Chris, did you want to add to that? I know you kind of cut each other off for a second.
I thought that was a great question. I mean, it was very, I don't think they saw it as a body of work. I'm not even sure how far they saw into the future that this would be preserved. But I think we were able to see it in retrospect. And it only became apparent to us as we saw it one after another that we were doing it.
I want to talk to you in depth about the book and how you laid it out. But before that, I just thought of another label too. World Pacific Jazz was another record label that featured and focused on jazz, especially with that name. But do you think there's something about jazz that gives birth to this synthesis that I referenced earlier between the visual art and the recording art? Or can that be duplicated in the world of, say, classical music or rock music or rhythm and blues, as they used to call it, et cetera? Or is it, do you think it's because of the unique nature of jazz and its improv energy?
I think you're probably onto something. I think that certainly rock music in the 60s, I think people felt by the end of the 60s when you had, I'm thinking of things influenced by the Fillmore posters and the Avalon posters and things like that, probably translated that rock energy. But I think jazz did have a very distinct sort of visual expression, a little more difficult with classical, because I can't think of a label that did a really consistent kind of branding with different imagery for classical music. Some good stuff, but I don't think it's sort of what you're suggesting. I think it was really coalescing around the music. And as Mark said, it's these designers and artists loved the music, and they really, because they weren't playing instruments, they wanted to be on the scene in some way and they wanted to be involved. And they were close to the musicians. They would attend sessions, you know. So
despite I think one of the other things to sort of keep in mind is that during the era that we feature in the book, the 1949 and 1960, I mean, jazz was current. It was cutting edge. It was boundary breaking. And I think these artists wanted to do the same with their art. We've got some great things from Reed Miles, who not only designed albums for Prestige, but also designed albums for Blue Note. And one of the things that he says is, you know, I wasn't that big of a jazz fan, but I understood what the music was and I understood how current it was. He understood how pioneering it was. And he said the same was true of the graphics that I tried to create for it. And I feel like in one way, it's very much about the artists and the designers striving for much the same thing.
And in the book, you obviously give representations of what that looked like as well. I get the feeling from talking to both of you that this had to happen because of your instinctual love of jazz particularly. In other words, you may like other forms of music, but I don't think you would have collaborated, even though you're both friends, on something of this big of a project, unless you really love the concept of jazz, and then that's the general concept, and then specifically in the world of Prestige Records.
Absolutely. It's the kind of thing where the project sort of unfolded as we got into it. You know, now that we're kind of at the end, Chris and I had talked about that a great deal. Like, you know, at the beginning, we knew that we appreciated the album covers of Prestige, And we knew that, as Chris said, there was a lot written about Blue Note album covers. But very often when we would talk about album covers that we really liked, we'd be talking about Blue Note, and then Prestige would pop up and we'd go, oh yeah, that really is one from Prestige. But you could see when you look at the artists, because a lot of the artists who work for Blue Note also work for Prestige. They work for Bethlehem, a number of different independent labels in New York at that time. So we kept coming back to the fact that there were so many Prestige albums that we thought just were so impressive and yet so underappreciated.
Were the two of you going to flea markets and used record stores to find some of these albums? Because clearly there's a lot out there and you were able to get access to it. So I was curious as to what the process was, or did you have friends who had copies of some of these albums, or is it a mix of everything?
I wish we could say that.
Or did you steal them all? Well, I mean, just now, guys.
I wish we had friends who had those albums. Even by the time we started this project in the early 2000s, the prices they were getting for these records were exorbitant. So you weren't really finding them, not in the flea markets that we were going to. So we were fortunate to sort of hook up with some collectors. Institute of Jazz Studies helped us at the beginning. Record stores that really specialize in this stuff. We would set up in a corner. Mark would bring the copy stand, his reflectors, his camera, and we would just shoot in a corner. Each of these albums, I'm glad you mentioned it, because each of the albums that are featured in the book were individually photographed. These weren't part of like a repository somewhere that we just went and were able to get the imagery. Every single one of these was tracked down and photographed as an actual object.
Yeah, and that's always a challenge too, because you have to make sure you're not getting reflection off of the album cover. Some of those album covers were pretty shiny.
So right, it's true.
Mark and his camera and his lighting got it just right.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Well, and the other thing that was a little bit of a challenge was, you know, we wanted to show the art in its best light, right? We wanted it to be like, when you look through the book, it's like these things just came off the press. We wanted to show them in the way that we felt the artists intended. And in order to do that, we had to go back to the original issues, the original pressings of the albums. And very often these albums were originally pressed in very, very small runs. And so it was difficult and time consuming to go back to try and find original editions of these first editions, if you will, of these albums and album covers. And the reason we did that was because we started out shooting third, fourth issue, generation issues rather, reissues, but the quality of the imagery was markedly better when we would go all the way back to the original edition, in some cases dramatically different. And so as we began to understand that, like, wow, we can really get back to the original artist's intent if we go the extra mile to shoot only first editions, that's when things really started to focus for us. But on the other hand, it made the albums that much more difficult to locate.
Well, I think the challenge too is that you, going back to the original cover, it's older, so it's been around longer, which means there could be some scratches, marks, spilled coffee, ice cream, whatever.
Absolutely. Yep. It's difficult to go back and find the originals, but in good enough condition to warrant photography.
Right. I just thought of this, and I don't know if there was one city or not, but what did Prestige as a label have its own recording studio, or did they subcontract out with other studios?
They subcontracted out to Rudy Van Gelder in the beginning, right? Rudy Van Gelder was their main engineer, and he had his studio in Hackensack, New Jersey. And oddly enough, it's Rudy, it's odd you'd ask that. Rudy Van Gelder's recording studio is actually what started this project, because Chris and I would sit and listen to music and look at these albums. And at the bottom corner, we would always see recorded by Van Gelder, Hackensack. And so, you know, you look at enough of those albums and you think, wow, you know, wonder what it was like up in Hackensack. We knew who Rudy Van Gelder was, but we thought maybe we could find that original place where it was recorded. And it turns out that it was recorded by Rudy Van Gelder in Rudy Van Gelder's parents' house. His father was a dentist and he was an optometrist. And he convinced his parents to allow him to turn their living room into a recording studio.
Amazing.
And so we actually drove up the turnpike to Hackensack one Saturday in a quest to try and find this house. So eventually, after a lot of driving around and looking through phone books at the Hackensack Library, we found the address, 15 Prospect Avenue. And when we got there, we thought, "Oh, this is it! You know, we're gonna find the Holy Grail here." And the only thing there was the parking lot for Hackensack Sports Medicine. And so, you know, we're standing there. It was a super cold day. I remember it like it was yesterday in January, and just, you know, kind of looking up at the sky, like we couldn't believe that so much incredibly important music was recorded here. And there's not a plaque, there's not a memorial, there's not any indication that you'd be anywhere where anything special happened, let alone something as transformative to American music as all of the albums recorded by Rudy Van Gelder during that era. And so it was a very quiet ride down the turnpike, as you might imagine. But that's the conversation about what was being lost and how much there is to be preserved and how much the music and the art of that era and what these people did of that era deserves recognition, was really the impetus for us to start the book project. So it really did all begin with Rudy Van Gelder.
When you started the project, did you try and find if there were any alive still, any of the people involved in Prestige Records on any level, including maybe even a Salesforce guy?
We tracked every single living. A lot of the people have passed away since we started, but we tracked every living person we found. Talked to Bob Weinstock, the founder of the label. All the living designers, Don Schlitten, Esmond Edwards, Scott Hyde. We did talk to somebody on the sales force. Really, these were all really expansive, generous people that gave us a lot of time. We talked to a man named Ralph Caffel, who was kind of a sales rep on the road for distribution. And he was great. He didn't know much about the design, but all these people spent a lot of time talking to us. And this is, you know, at a time when we were convinced we were going to get this project published. But at that time, it was really just on, we know this work is valuable. We know it's going to get done, but we didn't have a publisher at that point.
Well, I think, too, that even the sales guy can give you a sense of time and place, even if he wasn't involved in the artwork.
Yeah, exactly. And the idea of how many albums were being pressed. There's very little documentation out there in terms of how many of these things were pressed, when did they go to repress. And Prestige was notorious for issuing things with different covers as soon as it went into repress. And so to track it all was a huge task.
When you contacted the ones that you were able to, and then some, as you mentioned, subsequently died, but when you're initially in contacting these people in whatever realm of service they were in Prestige Records, were they uniformly enthusiastic about the project?
Absolutely. It was incredible. The generosity of all of the people who were connected to Prestige, as well as their families. We were really, really blessed to find people that not only were willing to talk with us, but had incredibly sharp recollections of specific questions, photo shoots for specific albums, the decisions behind certain things on the albums from decades previous. They really had a lot to offer us, and they were just so incredibly great to work with.
Well, I think too, it's a revisit for them when the two of you show up. Unfortunately, you didn't get to show up in time for the studio at the house, but you showed up enough to meet a lot of these people. I think it's a validation of their previous history and that you were showing an interest in it. So I think that they would be generous with their time and maybe even supply things physically that you may have not known you needed, but they contributed to the book itself, if that makes sense.
That absolutely turned out to be the case. We approached them with a sort of, we were always very kind of humble when we approached them, but as it turned out, I think they liked talking about that. I think they probably felt a little marginalized at that point.
Right.
So we did have people
sending out. All right.
Yeah. We did, we had people sending us pieces of, like old album cover slicks that they had held on to, like the, some photo experiments, things like that, that we were getting. That's what you'll see in the book, is so much of that stuff was provided to us by the designers themselves.
And I think too, you mentioned the families of some of these people, the families would appreciate what you're doing because it showcases their family member, whether it was a father or a grandfather or grandmother or whatever it happens to be, and validates again what they were doing at that time and place. And that it was important because the two of you are doing the research and writing the book.
Yes, I think that's true. I think, as it turns out, I think that's true. We really didn't know where things were going to go 20 years ago when we started it.
It is amazing. I want to talk to you why it took so long, but it's again called Whale, the Visual Language of Prestige Records. How did you come up with the title? And did the two of you agree or disagree? And
I'll let Mark answer. It went through a couple of permutations.
Yes.
But I'll let Mark answer.
I was aware of one of them, but go ahead, Mark.
Yes.
Yeah, there were a lot of titles that we went through over the years, but we landed on Whale. And when we did, we kind of both turned to each other and we were like, oh, wait, that's it. For the reason that one of the things that sort of distinguishes prestige is the idea that there's a more informal feel to the recording sessions, right? That it was much more about Bob Weinstock sort of taking musicians and putting them together in the studio to sort of see what would happen. And we have recollections from Sonny Rollins and a number of other folks that say at that point that other record album, labels, recording sessions felt a little bit more nuanced and practiced, right? As opposed to, let's get in to the studio and see if we can replicate what happens in a club or replicate what happens in a jam session. And the slang then for a jam session was to get together and wail. And there's actually a couple of prestige albums that have the word wail in them. The image that we use for the album cover is actually an album called Wail, Frank Wail. And that sort of impromptu, free-form, jam session kind of feel that so many folks have said was kind of in marked contrast to other labels was one of the things that we wanted to spotlight about prestige. Because the approach that Bob Weinstock took to the music, he also took to the art. You know, he says in the book, I viewed it all as art, the music and the covers. And he gave the artist a tremendous leeway in the concepts and the final executions. You know, he says, and this is actually corroborated by a number of designers, that he never rejected anything. It was driven solely by that designer's creative impetus. And so we just wanted to kind of pay tribute to that outlook that Bob had throughout prestige.
And to make the connection that the designers were also wailing in a way, you know, like the expression. So we just wanted to kind of make that connection.
I could see Louis Prima being part of that. It just right. Fit in very nicely. So did Bob make the trip down to Hackensack every time there was a recording session?
Yes. Either he did or one of his surrogates, Ira Gittler or Esmond Edwards, but he essentially supervised just about all the sessions in the 50s.
Do you think that this is the only label or only recording studio, in quotes, that is in Hackensack or was in Hackensack?
I would say yes. He moved right around the time when the coverage that we're doing up to 1960, Van Gelder moved to Englewood Cliffs into an actual studio, built a studio in Englewood Cliffs. And that was in about, I think that was about 1959. So that house, I think that was absolutely unique as a recording studio.
Why did it take you guys so long to write the book? I know, because you have day jobs. I get it. But still, that was a long time for research and writing and putting it all together.
Well, we started this. We'd get to points where we thought we were done, and then we'd continue to find things. We literally were putting, right before it went to press, we added a couple of things that we found that we had on file that we realized were directly relevant. So that's part of it. That's a big part of it.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it was a real emergent sort of process of doing the book. I mean, it started out as us simply wanting to show the imagery of the album covers. Mm-hmm. And so as we embarked on that, then through the contacts that we made, we were able to talk to one of the original artists. And through that contact, we were able to talk with a couple more people. And the idea eventually began to emerge that, hey, maybe it's not just the catalog of album covers. Maybe it's about some of the people that were involved. And then as we began to have more and more interviews and sort of refine our technique together, we began to realize that, you know what, this could be more than just an album, you know, catalog with a couple of interviews. We might be able to actually unpack the creative process of these people as they were doing the albums with actual physical examples from the creation of the albums and put together a book that's really about the creative process and happens to be about the albums and these people, which I think that's one of the things that kind of sets this book apart, is that it's got every bit as much content for appreciators of design and design process as it does for appreciators of music. But that certainly wasn't our initial intent when we started the book. It just emerged over time.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guests have been Chris Entwistle and Mark Havens, are authors of Whale, The Visual Language of Prestige Records. The book's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Bookshop.org, and RIT Press. And Chris and Mark, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Ira.
And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.